Welcome to Pod Save the World. I'm Tommy Vitor.
I'm Ben Rhodes.
Do you feel like you're better than me?
I do feel better than you.
The Jets demolished the Patriots.
The Mets are on the doorstep of a playoff spot.
I didn't lean into this. Steve Cohen, the owner of the Mets, is a huge asshole. He's a terrible person.
Yeah, but he's our asshole.
Okay, I just want to make sure you know
he's
that.
He's like a right
lashing
winner,
back. Hurt people, Ben. Yeah.
I'll take it. Like, partisanship stops at the diamond's edge.
Yeah.
But yeah, we did handle the Patriots pretty easily, I have to say.
You guys are quite good. We should just be Dodgers fans.
Ohtani. I mean, there's a world-o angle there. I mean,
big time.
Best player, like, maybe ever.
Like, one of the best players in the history of baseball, Shohei Ohtani. If you guys don't know, he just entered the 50-50 club, which means 50 home runs and 50 stolen bases. And normally he pitches.
Yes.
But he's not pitching this year because he's been injured.
And he did it by going 6-for-6 with 10 RBIs and 3 home runs.
It's like,
what the hell's going on?
That's like video game stats.
I saw the stats and I was like, oh, it was a doubleheader? I was like, no, it's all in one game.
One game. Yeah, what an absolute stud athlete. We won't talk about the gambling. We got a great show for you today, Ben. We're going to talk about the major escalation in the war between Israel and Hezbollah and why Israel keeps shutting down Al Jazeera's offices across the region. We're going to talk about President Biden's speech at the UN General Assembly and what UNGA's value even is these days, if there is any.
We should just add, Tommy, Rhodes Map, the latest addition to the Pod Save the World YouTube channel. Alone and I broke down the UN General Assembly.
I know. Yeah. I got a sweet inline plug later.
Get some good feedback on the name Rhodes Map.
Okay.
Which I did not come up with.
I like that. Where'd that come from? Where in the brainstorm? Is that an Alona special?
There's no bad ideas in the brainstorm. Comedy Corner.
You know, Rhodes Map. I like that.
Keeps turning out the hits.
Yeah. Rhodes Map. The Oslo. Never mind. Yeah. We're also going to talk about Zelensky's visit to the U.S., his victory plan, and his little swing state tour.
Yeah, I like that.
Get him on a bus, get him hitting some doors. Also, his choice words for J.D. Vance. I like that
very
even more.
Very choice, yeah.
We're also going to get into a little more polling about national security. We enjoyed that last week so much. We got some more data for you guys. Another worrisome election in Germany, a political sea change in Sri Lanka, how Elon Musk ended up caving in Brazil, a super yacht full of classified information, fun report out of Albania that I know you're excited about.
Yeah, I'm very excited about this.
And then more zoo fraud. And then, Ben, you did the interview today, this morning. What did you talk about?
I talked to Kim Gaddis, who's a great journalist, a Lebanese journalist based in Beirut, writes for the Financial Times and The Atlantic and other publications. Kim talked about what is the mood like in Beirut and Lebanon generally, what precautions are people taking. We talked about Hezbollah, the role they play in Lebanese politics, and how they've been dealt a blow by Israel's recent operations, but also kind of where is this going? Why is Israel doing this? But, you know, she called out, I think, some things we don't see in our media, which is what Israeli ministers are saying about, like, annexing southern Lebanon and all Lebanese being Hezbollah. I mean,
yeah, that was the education minister, right? It said all Lebanese are the same as Hezbollah.
Worrying echoes of the early Gaza days. And so it's a very sobering but very good interview. People should check it out.
She's a real deal expert in
real
the region.
She's the real deal.
Definitely worth listening to. I'm excited to hear that. Well, let's start in Lebanon because it's just a huge story right now. So the fighting has escalated. I saw this AP report. It's like, is it a full-blown war? It's like, what are you talking about? Of course it is.
How many bombs have to go off before it's a war? Yeah.
There were hundreds of airstrikes this week. The airstrikes in southern Lebanon by Israel killed more than 550 people, according to Lebanon's health ministry, and injured more than 1,600. This was the deadliest day of fighting between Israel and Hezbollah since the 2006 war, which no one would dispute was a major conflict. The Israeli strikes come shortly after the very high-profile pager and walkie-talkie sabotage attacks that we talked about last week. Those were the operations by Israeli intelligence on Hezbollah operatives. The IDF says now they are hitting Hezbollah infrastructure, leadership, weapons depots, you know, like stockpiles of rockets, other military targets. On Tuesday, the IDF said they killed a senior Hezbollah commander. Last week, an airstrike in Beirut reportedly took out a bunch of senior commanders in Hezbollah's most elite fighter unit, the Radwan Commando Unit. That's the unit that's trained to do a lot of cross-border operations into Israel. That said, a lot of these strikes are in major population centers and have also killed civilians, including children. You're going to hear much more about this situation on the ground from Ben and Kim in Beirut. But Ben, it feels like this is the beginning of something bigger. I mean, you got Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu telling people in southern Lebanon to evacuate north. He's saying things like, we're preparing for the next phase of the conflict. I assume that could include a ground operation. Axios reported that Israeli and Western intelligence officials believe that Hezbollah has asked Iran to respond directly to Israel. Luckily, that hasn't happened yet. But the Pentagon has already announced they are sending what was described as a small number of additional U.S. troops to the region on top of, I think, 40,000 who are already there, a couple aircraft carriers, like serious hardware. And so, Ben, you know, with the caveat that Israel and Hezbollah have been trading rocket attacks for the better part of the year. In fact, I think Israel says Hezbollah has launched 900 rocket and drone attacks into Israel since October 7th of last year. It seems like, I mean, is it fair to say that this broader, you know, Biden international effort to avoid escalation has just completely failed at this point?
Yeah, I mean, Tommy, but by any measure, this has been a total failure of U.S. policy, including, you know, what they were saying publicly. And urging de-escalation and avoiding precisely this outcome, it's come to pass, you know. And the U.S. just appears to be a completely passive actor. I mean, the fact that we're sending aircraft carriers and once again insurging to protect our own troops, you know. So let's keep in mind what the sequence is. We urge Israel to not escalate a conflict in Lebanon because we know that it could lead to kind of regional war. Israel completely ignores the United States, escalates without even telling us they're doing it. And so what? We rush military assets to protect our own people against what our allies doing over our objections. It's just right. A bizarro world of feckless policy, you know.
And constant escalation. Yeah, I mean, yeah. Killing Hamas leaders in Tehran, this walkie-talkie and pager assassination, the increased airstrikes. I mean, it's a series of things, as you just pointed out.
Yeah, and again, if we're not willing to use any leverage on the Israeli government, and the Israeli government is willing to completely ignore every single thing that we tell them as U.S. government, what are we doing here, guys?
Right.
You know, I mean, I don't know what else to say. Now, in terms of the dynamics on the ground, I mean, Israel is dealing huge blows to Hezbollah. There's no question about that. But the question is, where does this go? I mean, Hezbollah is not going to disappear. Like Hamas, they're not going to come out and surrender. I have people I know who rightly point out, you know, there are 40,000 Israelis at least displaced from northern Israel. You know, that's unacceptable to a sovereign country. Well, there are also tens of thousands of Lebanese displaced from southern Lebanon. We never talk about them.
A lot more now, too.
I guess they're not people or something, right. You know. Right. But they're displaced as well. And do we think those 40,000 people are going to be able to go home because Hezbollah people are being killed? I don't know. I mean, you know, that would mean Hezbollah would have to essentially kind of admit defeat. So I just don't know where this is going. And if you combine this with what's happening in Gaza and what's happening in the West Bank, it's escalating everywhere, certainly in Lebanon and the West Bank. It's only not escalating in Gaza because it's been a steady state of conflict. And it's just, where is this all going? Where does this all end?
Yeah. And just like, I think you get into this with Kim a little more later, but just it's worth talking for a minute just about the broader political and economic situation in Lebanon, because I think that context is important when you think about what the impact of this war could be on the Lebanese people, because it's not an exaggeration to say that Lebanon is experiencing one of the worst economic collapses in history. Like when you look at like the IMF data, they defaulted on their debt in 2020, right at the start of the pandemic. Later on that year, there was that massive explosion at the port in Beirut. Their currency has lost 98% of its value. There's runaway inflation. Like the banking sector is basically collapsed. If you have money in a bank, you either can't get it out or what you get out is worth a fraction of what you put in because you're given the Lebanese lira. And this financial crisis has just like impacted every part of life, healthcare, energy supplies, everything. And so like, yes, Hezbollah, it's a terrorist organization. They have a militant wing. There's no love lost for those guys. Like they want Israel not to exist. They want to kill civilians. But they also do provide these social services, including medical care. They have food banks. They have welfare services. They even started like a shadow economy and a shadow banking system to fill some of the void. And like, again, no one's saying this is a good way to run a railroad. I'm sure almost all of this money is getting steered only to the Shia population. But this war and like the further disruption of everything that's happening in Lebanon is going to impact everybody.
Well, that's, yeah. And Kim makes this point that like it should also be emphasized that, you know, they're not the only health service in Lebanon, that there's a complex, multidimensional Lebanese state. And Hezbollah is a part of that. It's
right.
Not all of that.
Right.
And she makes that point because this is a war on Lebanon. You know, I mean, they can call it a war against Hezbollah, but the bombs are going off in the middle of Beirut. The pager attacks, you know, targeted Hezbollah, but went off all across the country, and that terrorized, like, the broader population as well. And that's not my words. That's exactly how Kim described it, right? And you would think, you know, if things were blowing up all over Los Angeles, you wouldn't think that there was a war just against, like, some gang in Los Angeles. It would feel like... So I make this point that to suggest that somehow there's not a broader cost, as you say, to the Lebanese people, including a lot of people that don't like Hezbollah and aren't part of Hezbollah, is just to ignore what is happening in front of us, you know? And how long can this go on where there's just this disregard for the civilian population that is caught up in the midst of these wars? And, you know, every time you hear again about, understandably, rightly, absolutely correctly, about the civilian cost to some, you know, to these displaced Israeli citizens, it's like, well, why is the logic applied there and not to civilians in places like Lebanon in particular? It's, you know, they've just been subject to one tragedy after another, you know, and I start to wonder too, like, how long can this war go on, you know, without, again, the West Bank blowing up more, or Jordan becoming unstable as their, you know, very large Palestinian population starts to ask, why is the Jordanian government not doing anything about this? Or Egypt is a very brittle state. I mean, we're just not, we're living with a degree of risk in this kind of multifaceted, ever-changing war that I think, you know, leads in dangerous directions.
Yeah, and that quote from the Israeli Minister of Education was, there is no difference between Hezbollah and Lebanon. Lebanon will be annihilated. It will cease to exist.
Well, like, there you go. I mean, that's not me saying, you know, sometimes you say these things and be like, how dare you say that? Israel's at war with Lebanon. Well, listen to that. You know? Like, these are people in the government, you know?
Yeah, and listen, Lebanon is also sheltering, you know, a couple million Syrian refugees. And also, but just like, it's not all Hezbollah. I mean, two-thirds of Lebanon is Muslim. It's basically half Sunni, half Shia. 30% of the country is Christian, 5% of the country is Druze. So there's a lot of people in there that probably really hate Hezbollah.
Yeah.
You know, and they're suffering too because of this war.
And the previous, you know, the 1982 Israeli military invasion of Lebanon helped kind of fuel what became, you know, seemingly endless civil war. The 2006 war did not go well for anybody. Like, these wars, you know, again, you can degrade Hezbollah's capability, you can kill a bunch of their leaders, but they don't solve the problem. I mean, I don't know how many times we have to learn this.
Yeah. Another thing we just want to flag, I mean, you mentioned the West Bank earlier, Ben. So on Sunday, the IDF raided and shut down the office of Al Jazeera in the West Bank. The Israeli government said that they're ordered to be closed for 45 days. This was on the order of the military, which had determined that the office was being used to incite terror in some way. We should note that Al Jazeera operates in part of the West Bank referred to as Area A, which is supposed to be under full Palestinian control. So this is a pretty surprising move by the Israelis. Back in May, the Israeli government passed a law that allowed the government to shut down foreign media outlets that are deemed a national security threat. The shutdowns are supposed to last 44 days, but they can be renewed, and they have been renewed. But after this law passed, I mean, Israeli authorities quickly moved on. It's called the Al Jazeera Law in Israel, and they moved to shut down Al Jazeera's offices in East Jerusalem. So, I mean, I think, you know, the world is losing a major source of reporting on Gaza, the West Bank, the conflict generally. And also, it's important to note, just for context, that Israel all but bans international journalists from entering the Gaza Strip to cover it. There, if you get in, you're basically, you're pre-approved or with a minder, you're escorted around with some like IDF unit. So I don't know, Ben, when like Vladimir Putin or Viktor Orban or Nicolas Maduro does stuff like this, the response is pretty unequivocal. I tried to look around. I didn't read every State Department briefing, but I've not heard as much from the U.S. on this one.
No, and there's no credible reason. You know, they talk about incitement. I mean, Al Jazeera, they may not like their editorial line, but they're a journalistic entity that's been reporting on what's going on there. We've seen journalists killed in the West Bank, including Shireen Abadi, an American journalist for Al Jazeera. But your point is the right one about Gaza. Like, if there's a commitment to the freedom of the press, and B, if there's not, you know, war crimes being committed, why are we almost a year into this war and no journalist is allowed to just go report in Gaza, not even allowed to go in there? And they're shutting down media outlets in the West Bank. If you don't want people to see what's going on, it's a pretty good indication that there's something that should be reported on, but it's getting increasingly difficult to actually get on the ground in these places.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, I don't think this will be the last time we're talking about this. But let's turn to Anga, Ben, because unfortunately for all New Yorkers, leaders and delegations from over 150 countries are in New York for the UN General Assembly. Zelensky and Biden, I think, both already spoke today. Netanyahu is scheduled to speak later, although he delayed his trip, I think, at one point because of this Hezbollah operation. So I'm not sure what his deal is. But either way, it's going to be a showcase of every conflict and rift and crisis happening in the world, as well as the inability for the UN to fix them. Even the UN Secretary General has admitted that the UN Security Council has been a failure and has done nothing to stop the wars in Gaza, Sudan, and Ukraine. So in terms of just like the UN itself, Ben, heading into UNGA this year, the U.S. proposed adding two new permanent seats for African countries and a non-permanent seat for small island developing nations. So that's sort of an interesting attempt at reforming the institution. Although I did see that our ambassador, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, said that the U.S. opposes giving those African countries veto power, because the veto is what makes the UN Security Council so dysfunctional. So we'll see if this proposal goes anywhere. Biden's speech, as you know better than anyone, and as UNGA speeches often do, it's tour of the region.
Yes.
You're talking
tour
about
the horizon.
You're talking about a lot of stuff briefly. But, you know, so he hit on Ukraine, Gaza, Hezbollah, you know, a lot of different stuff. But there was also kind of a personal element that was interesting from Biden about his own sort of political fortune and changes lately. Let's hear a clip.
Being president has been the honor of my life. There's so much more I want to get done. As much as I love the job, I love my country more. I decided after 50 years of public service, it's time for a new generation of leadership to take my nation forward. My fellow leaders, let us never forget, some things are more important than staying in power. It's your people. It's your people that matter the most. Never forget, we are here to serve the people, not the other way around.
So I know Biden said some of that stuff before, but I did think in that room,
yeah,
a bunch of people who are willing to like tear up their own constitution at times to cling to power, it's pretty powerful.
Yeah, I mean, the first part is like the exact verbatim that we heard,
yeah.
You know, but then that line that he used, that was, I think, specific to the room, right, about giving a power. The line that drew the applause, you know, you have to bear in mind that most of the people sitting in that audience, or at least a lot of them, are not in a position where they have any interest in giving up power whatsoever.
No.
And, you know, I think it's a reminder that for all the dysfunction in the United States and all the dysfunction in our politics and all the kind of autocratic tendencies that we have on display, that there's still something that the United States can offer the world that is positive, which is the example of a peaceful transition of power. If Kamala Harris wins, the example of a generational transition of power, the example of a multiracial candidate and the first female president getting elected, that we can still show the world like a better story, not just about ourselves, but about how politics can function. And so I think that was, you know, really a powerful statement at a time when, you know, democracy is moving in the wrong direction in so many places. You know, he's kind of planting a really important flag there about, you know, the imperative in any democratic society of people being willing to relinquish power.
Yeah, I think we're so close to all of this just happening that we're going to remember kind of the role pressure played and Nancy Pelosi and
Pots
Chuck Schumer, a bunch of arrogant, self-important podcasters. But I do think, like, when history kind of pulls back on this moment, it will be a pretty profound example of, you know, resetting after January 6th.
No, look, and we're living through an historical epic, right? And if we come out of it, you know, which I hope
knock
we will,
wood.
Knock on wood, you know, I think we'll look back and when you're looking at the moments that helped kind of keep things moving forward or kept democracy alive, like the Joe Biden decision to step aside, you know, will feature on that list again. And he himself was the first to acknowledge that if Kamala Harris wins, you know, it'll look a certain way in a year. And if he loses, you know, if she loses, it won't. So, but yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think to the rest of the world, that's a very unusual thing that he did.
Yeah. I don't know. Do you make anything of these UN Security Council resolution kind of tweaks that the U.S. has put forward? Or like David Miliband suggesting suspending the UN Security Council resolution veto powers during a conflict, which kind of raises the question, when are we not in a conflict? But I don't know, like all these different tweaks or changes to the UN system to make it work better. Because like part of me wanted to walk in here and make fun of it with you and be like, why the hell do we even go anymore? It's useless. But then I imagine a scenario where Trump wins re-election, he just stops showing up, and clearly that would be worse.
Yeah. No, and we talked about this in Rhodes Map, but I think it's a positive thing to offer this reform. The U.S. has tried to take steps in recent years to increase representation, particularly from Africa, on different international institutions. So I think they brought the AU, the African Union, into the G20 as like a kind of permanent member of that enterprise. And this has long been a complaint among developing countries that they're not represented on the Security Council. In the Obama years, we actually came out in favor of India having a permanent seat.
Right. Yeah.
So this is, you know, reform kind of never happens, you know, but, you know, it's worth trying. And it's worth putting this out. What is striking is these are clearly geopolitical interests, right? The Pacific Island states and Africa are kind of venues for this competition between the U.S. and China. And here's the U.S. trying to show, hey, look, we want to evolve the international system to be more representative. It's, you know, going to take more work to actually implement anything. Without Security Council reform more broadly in terms of how the veto works, it's not going to solve the dysfunction, because you can have all the new members you want, but if essentially the great powers are at odds and they're using their vetoes to obstruct any action on big geopolitical issues, the Security Council matters less. So I'd love to see like a real meaningful reform of the UN system and the UN Security Council, but absent the great powers agreeing, you're not going to get there. So a lot of these proposals kind of have, you know, more of a messaging function than anything else.
Yeah. Yeah. Well said. Last quick thing on this. So I think I noticed that both Biden and Kamala Harris met with Mohammed bin Zayed, or MBZ, the president of the UAE, who is making the first visit by an Emirati president to the U.S. since 1971. I know that, you know, there was a very extensive readout that went out from the White House. Thank you, NSC team, for all that good stuff. But Sudan was mentioned. I hope they pushed him really fucking hard about stopping weapon sales to the RSF, the paramilitary force in Sudan that is one half of the civil war that's leading to the worst famine on the globe right now. I saw there was a great letter from five Democrats, Pramila Jayapal, Barbara Lee, Sarah Jacobs, Ilhan Omar, and Dan Kildee, calling on Biden to raise the support of the RSF by the UAE, but let's just hope it came up.
I'm sure it came up. I mean, the question is like, you know, how hard this was pushed. And I have to say, like, I genuinely don't understand why the UAE is so compelled to be doing this. I just don't.
I mean, don't either.
I'm sure that they have some kind of corrupt interest there. There's oil in Sudan, or there's relationships that they built up with the RSF in Yemen and places like that. But there's a reputational cost to the UAE. I mean, this is not a, you know, this is now like widely known, this support for the RSF and how it's contributing to the crisis. And so part of the message has to be this is in your interest. This, you know, your interest is not to kind of be seen as this kind of supporter of this pariah militia committing genocidal acts of violence in Sudan. Hopefully that message gets through and we can see a shift.
Yeah. Do you want to get a table at Cafe Milano?
Yeah. Well,
you're not going to be welcome to official Washington.
I don't know. They'll always get the table.
Yeah, I was going to say, they'll buy the whole restaurant. Yeah. Also, Ben, so we mentioned before, Zelensky's in the U.S. He says he's bringing a victory plan. He's not going to talk about the specifics of it publicly until he's discussed it with Biden. But he did sort of get asked about this in an ABC interview that aired on Monday. Here's a clip from that.
Your victory plan, does it include, and I know you don't want to get into details until you talk to leaders, but negotiating with Russia, and how can you trust someone?
It's not about negotiating with Russia. No, it's about, like I said, it's a bridge to diplomatic way how to stop the war. The bridge is a plan of victory, or victorious plan. It's a strengthening of Ukrainian army and Ukrainian people. Only in the strong position we can push, Putin to stop the war diplomatic way.
So I'm guessing it'll have a bunch of the previous asks, like we want to hit, you know, use Western weapons, hit targets in Russia, ongoing military support over some like 10-year horizon or something, you know, a pathway into the EU, pathway into NATO. Zelensky also is going to brief members of Congress and the Harris and Trump campaigns on the plan. The Trump meeting will be fun after Zelensky took a big whack at J.D. Vance in The New Yorker. He's also, I think he already spoke to the UN General Assembly. But Ben, what really caught my eye about Zelensky's visit was he took a trip to Scranton, Pennsylvania, to visit an ammunition factory that makes 155-millimeter artillery shells. Those shells are used in the howitzer artillery system that's been critical for the Ukrainian military to help, you know, fight back against the Russians. Zelensky took a 90-minute tour along with Governor Josh Shapiro and Senator Bob Casey. No press was allowed, but they released a video of Shapiro and Zelensky like signing some shell casings afterwards and thanking workers. Here's a brief clip.
You said that 400 people work here, but I wanted very much to come here and to thank you. 400 people saved millions of Ukrainians. Because of the result of your work, I'm very thankful, just from ordinary Ukrainians to you. And what can I say? Thank you so much. You helped us to survive against Putin invasion.
What do you think of this swing state tour? Like, savvy, strange, too cute? Like, I can't really decide.
I love the swing state
tour. You like
it? Yeah, I love it. I mean,
get him on a bus?
Yeah, get him on the bus tour, you know? I will say, I mean, first on the victory plan, Zelensky is clearly trying to set up a kind of situation in which they know they may not reclaim every inch of territory, but there's a kind of psychological victory that can be won, you know? And it clearly does involve escalation against Russia, letting them use those longer range weapons, and just kind of getting a sense of an advantage that, you know, they want to be in a stronger position heading into some negotiations, and they want to come out of it stronger because of security assurances, because of EU membership and things like this. So he's making a bit of a turn, but it's still very much on Ukraine's terms, which, you know, you'd expect from him. I think on Pennsylvania, look, he's doing a couple things. One, separate from the election, I mean, just highlighting the fact that the money that is appropriated by Congress in these supplemental bills for Ukraine, like, genuinely goes to support jobs in the U.S., that's a smart message, you know.
Three cheers for the military-industrial complex.
Yeah, I know. All of a sudden, a bunch of liberals, you know, are like cheering the military-industrial
artillery
complex.
Artillery shells.
Yeah, get some Raytheon factories open, you know.
Howitzer.
And then, like, on the swing state piece and the shot he took at J.D. Vance, you know, we called him like a radical.
You want me to read a quote?
Yeah, yeah.
Let Mr. Vance read up on the history of the Second World War when a country was forced to give part of its territory to one particular person, Zelensky said. What did that man do? Was he appeased or did he deal a devastating blow to the continent of Europe, to many nations broadly, and to the Jewish nation in particular? Let him do some reading. Yeah. That's a shot.
Yeah. I mean, he could have added that he, you know, one of us looks better with a beard you know, than the other.
It might have well said, comma, you dumb fuck.
You asshole. He could have added like a couch joke by the way. He was so savage, you know? But the reality is that, like, if you're Zelensky, like, this guy ran out of fucks like a long time ago. Uh-huh. And so there's, oh, you know, what's he doing in swing states? Well, you know what? He's helping his country.
I kind of like it.
It's like,
why not?
And he's not like endorsing Kamala Harris. He's not like he's doing, you know, message events. Well, it kind of is, I guess.
He was nice to Trump in this interview.
He was nice to Trump in the interview, too. But, I mean, I don't know. Like, I think his thought with Trump is, look, first of all, Trump may like him more for taking the shot at J.D. Vance. You know what I mean? Like Trump kind of respects.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously, like,
I think that's true.
Trump respects kind of strong men who, like, say, you know, ominous, like, threatening things about people. And so I actually don't think the Vance thing hurts him with Trump. And I think Zelensky's view is probably like, you know what? I clearly prefer the Democrats to win. My thumb's on the scale a little bit in that direction. And if Trump wins, I'm just going to have to deal with it. And I'll try to deal with it in my own kind of strongman Ukrainian way. You know, I'll cross that bridge if I have to. But I'd obviously prefer these people over here are in power.
Yeah.
You know? Now, I will say,
but JD, you're PNG'd preemptively.
Well, JD, yeah, you're not coming to the, you know, you're not coming to Kyiv in the train anytime soon. But like the thing I don't get, Tommy, if you were the Harris campaign, I mean, maybe this is too worldly of me, but given how tight these margins are going to be, why is she not doing like diaspora events, not just the weapons factory like this one, but like there are large, not just Ukrainian diaspora, but Polish diaspora, you know, Eastern European diaspora. And these are people that are, you know, white, skew Republican, but probably really hate Trump's Russia policy. I mean, do you think there's space for her to get out or Waltz and do some of these kinds of engagements in Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin?
Yeah, probably, yeah. Or at least some surrogates.
Yeah.
What's a big, you know, Polish national security type?
Was he big? But I don't know. I just...
I previously forgot it passed away.
I honestly think it's worth...
There's a younger Brzezinski. He was the ambassador to Poland.
Yeah, Mark Brzezinski, good guy. Like, but I honestly think that, like, this is worth the, you know, one of the top two people doing something, because these people care a lot, and this is like a voting issue for them.
I agree.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the politics.
I mean, because normally the surrogate is like, you know, you send like Timothy Schneider or something, you know, and it's not like, I mean, it's great, but it's not like moving votes, you know?
I think Walls is probably going to get through the debate and then do a lot more interviews, events and things, yeah. But they're just kind of waiting to get through October 1st. But yeah, I think there's room to do a lot more all over the place, I think. Well, let's talk about the politics. We got this more good polling. So this time we got a poll from the Institute for Global Affairs.
As good as the National Security Action Poll.
But well, I wanted to clarify that too, up high. This polling was featured exclusively.
It's like Bad Nate.
No, what a day. I've had a bunch of people email and be like, who's Bad Nate? Who's Good Nate? And it's like, whichever one's most recent poll I liked, Good Nate. So the What a Day newsletter, which if you're not subscribe, because it's an excellent newsletter. They had this exclusively on Monday. But basically this organization, Institute for Global Affairs, polled about 2,000 Americans on foreign policy issues. They did some subsamples where they dug into like Rust Belt, swing states, etc. But big picture, on Israel and Gaza, Ben, majorities of both Democrats and independents think the U.S. should either end support for Israel's war effort or make that support conditional on a ceasefire. Good to know. 42% of Republicans think the U.S. should support Israel unconditionally. For Democrats, that number drops to 8%. On just sort of a national level, Harris is viewed as stronger than Trump on improving Washington's reputation on the world stage, being a strong leader, and avoiding sending American troops into unnecessary conflicts, but only barely on that last one or last two. But Trump does better on who's more likely to reform immigration and the wars in Gaza and Ukraine and respond effectively to attack on Taiwan. You'll like this, Ben. 66% of Democrats and 45% of Republicans think the U.S. should normalize relations with Cuba.
All right, here we go.
Just get Florida out of this conversation. Democrats say their top foreign policy issues are climate change. Republicans say their top issue, singular, is immigration. I would personally argue that neither of those issues is just like a purely foreign policy, but kind of interesting that it popped. Two-thirds of voters want to see NATO and the U.S. push for a negotiated settlement of the war in Ukraine. 58% of Harris supporters think the U.S. should maintain or increase the number of U.S. troops overseas, while 58% of Trump supporters would like to see a decrease in the number of troops abroad. So bombarding you with stats there. Lots more interesting stuff, though. I do think there's like a few warning signs for Democrats in there, like stuff we talk about a lot, like Ukraine, threats to democracy internationally were rated very low on the list of priorities people said they cared about. But I don't know, anything jump out at you in this survey?
I mean, I think what jumps out in all these surveys in a way is the kind of tribal identity politics that we see in every issue has kind of completely crept into foreign policy, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, immigration is a right-wing issue and climate change is this. And if you want to fight climate change, you also want to help Ukraine. Like these are things that didn't used to correlate, you know,
right.
But the kind of sorting that's taken place is kind of replicated on foreign policy. And so that I think stands out. I think, you know, the gap between public opinion on issues like Israel and Cuba and politicians kind of just continues to be glaring. And that's, I think, in part because interest groups are, you know, more powerful than public opinion on those issues.
Really? Still sometimes. In Cuba? Who is pushing for that?
Well,
is it just Florida politics?
It's just far, and it's the number of members of Congress who care about it. The anti-Cuban hardliners care a lot, you know. So like Marco Rubio is gonna, he's gonna, you know, grind the Senate to a halt over it,
right,
or something,
right,
you know.
Right.
And other people need to care more about changing it. And the same thing is true of Israel policy. So that, you know, that uncomfortable gap between public opinion and policy is clear. And then the last thing I'd say, and Tommy, I don't know what you think about this, is that, you know, the ending the war in Ukraine and Gaza being an advantage for Trump is, you know, I get why. You know, Trump would end the war faster in Ukraine by essentially cutting them off and But I think that should be more worrying to Democrats. You know, this idea that we're kind of the permanent war, military, industrial complex, globalization party. Like,
me too, man.
I'm not comfortable being associated with that, you know, even though I want to support Ukraine. But I just, when you paint a broad brush, it just kind of looks like we're constantly defending a status quo that people don't like. You know, they don't like globalization. They don't like wars. They don't like, you know, all this, you know, chaos around the world. And we got to take that seriously. I don't know. Like, God forbid we lose this election. I hope not. But if we do, I think one of the things we'll be looking back on is, like, why do we keep defending all these status quos that people are pissed about?
Yeah, I was fighting with a member of Congress about this today, who's like a pretty firm defender of kind of the Biden policy in Israel, and not of Netanyahu, but of like kind of Gallant.
Wait a second. How can you be a defender of the Biden policy and not be a defender of Netanyahu? You know, like that. Well, yeah, I know he wouldn't see it that way, but
Fair point. Yeah. But I mean, I just sent this political story with the headline "U.S. sending small number of troops to Middle East as attacks ramp up." I'm like, this is a bad fucking headline for Kamala Harris and Democrats, because what people don't want across the political spectrum is more money for wars and more chaos on their TVs, and not that they read the newspaper, but, you know, their social media feeds, and just the feeling of insecurity that comes from being bombarded with scary events overseas that are tied to us and threats and terrorism. Like, this is not a good setup.
Yeah. And just politically, because you know, Biden administration or Democratic Party, were uncomfortable, like, having the fight that would inevitably emerge if you try to use leverage back in the spring, right? Or the winter or the fall, and saying we're going to, you know, condition military assistance. Because you didn't want to have that political problem, you now have the political problem 5 weeks before an election of headlines about U.S. forces potentially getting into a war in the Middle East, which is, I can guarantee you, far more consequential to voters than, you know, whether there's some criticisms of you holding up 2,000-pound bomb weapon shipments to Israel. And, you know, God forbid we actually end up in that conflict. You know, I mean, this is not the October you want. I'm sure it wasn't the UNGA speech that President Biden wanted. He wanted to kind of herald his accomplishments. I'm sure that may have something to do with Bibi Netanyahu's timing, you know, and we just have to be aware of that.
Yeah. And just to check us on our bullshit for a second, we are worldos. We're very like seized with this stuff. There was a huge conversation about like Gaza and campus politics and how animated young people were by this. The Harvard Institute just came out today with its youth poll. They looked at like top issues for 18 to 29 year olds. The top was the economy at 14%. Israel-Palestine barely rated with 1%. So this is, it's seemingly, I don't know if it's always been the case or if it's dropped from the headlines, so therefore it's sort of like dropped in salience among voters. It's not like a huge animating issue in the electorate broadly. Maybe there are several tens of thousands of voters in Michigan, for example, who voted uncommitted, who will stay home, who could tip the election from Harris to Biden. We don't know. I'm not saying it's irrelevant. I think everything matters in this election. But I think you're making a broader point. I'm making a broader point about like war and spending money on wars and scary images overseas, and that being a thing that politically could move the needle like on the cusp of an election.
And I just think you're right. You should not overstate, you know, how much people care about an issue like Gaza. I think politically that issue is really a Michigan issue where the margins are small. So if enough people care,
big Palestinian community. Yeah.
I think more broadly though, the thing I'd add to your point about war, Tommy, is also just like non-responsive elites, you know? So like, and this is where the Israel piece comes into it. It's like people clearly do not think it is a good idea to provide billions and billions and billions of unconditioned military assistance to Israel. And politicians ignore that sentiment. And that happens a lot on foreign policy. You know? And so to me, the Israel question kind of rolls into this bigger question of like, if I'm looking at the U.S. government, I'm wondering, there's something cynical about it. You know, like we say one thing and we're doing another thing. You know, we say we want this war to stop, but we give the weapons for it. But also just sense of like, in foreign policy in particular, like, why is nobody listening to what people think?
Also, are we in charge? Do we have any sway?
We
can't make this end. Why not? Yeah. Anyway, Ben, before we go to break, I got a great show for you for when this is over, for the listeners when this is over. Empire City. It is a deeply reported history of the NYPD.
Yeah.
They go back to like the 1840s and 50s to look at the origins of the NYPD and how it has evolved thanks to the media, thanks to concern about crime, thanks to all these elements, into the organization that the NYPD is today, the very troubled organization it is today, but also how the NYPD like kind of developed the systems and structures that led to a lot of the challenges in policing that we've seen explode in our political discourse the last few years. It's really good.
I caught your interview
with Chenjerai
on PSA, and I have to say, like, he seems like an incredibly smart, interesting, compelling, charismatic guy that you want to spend a few episodes
also with. Also, was a rapper.
I can't wait to check it out.
In the 90s.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
We talk about that in the interview.
More interesting than my life.
Anyway, mine too. I was a field staffer.
You were a bus driver and I was a film fiction writer. Van driver, yeah, sorry.
So anyway, check it out. Check out Empire City. It's from Wondery, Crooked Media, and Push Black. You can find Empire City wherever you get your podcasts, and you can binge all episodes early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Also, we're a month out, basically, from Election Day. This is your reminder to, one, register to vote.
Yep.
Tell your friends to register to vote. Make a plan to vote. Volunteer if you have not. But also, maybe grab a copy of Democracy or Else to get you through the home stretch. It's the book that Lovett, Favreau, and I wrote. It's about all our fun political insights from Pod Save America and all our time in politics, including some great anecdotes and insights from people like Ben Rhodes.
I'm right in there. Yeah.
Sitting right across from me. Every book is also making a difference because Crooked Media is donating its profits from Democracy or Else to support Vote Save America in 2024 campaigns. Go to crooked.com/books or your local bookstore to get your copy of Democracy or Else now.
Hi, my name is Mitch Landrieu.
My name is Erin Haynes.
My name is Jennifer Palmieri, and we're hosting a new series called Long Play. The South is the new political epicenter of the country. Democrats are way on their heels in this region, but Republicans are going through their own reckoning in the South, too.
I mean, the South has always shaped American politics. We know that.
The stakes could not be higher, but to win the South, you have to understand it.
People in the South feel really misunderstood, left behind, put down on, and they want to explain that to somebody.
We're traveling across six southern states to explore the people, the issues, the assumptions that no longer hold, and what the rest of us are missing about a region that will shape the future of our politics and our country. From Left, Right, and Crooked Media, starting July 27th. Watch Long Play series on YouTube at youtube.com/longplayseries or listen wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, let's do another quick Germany update, Ben. A couple weeks ago, we talked about two state elections in Germany where the far-right AfD party did way too well for comfort. They got the most votes in a state called Thuringia and got a close second in Saxony. Now we have one more set of local elections out of Brandenburg, one of my favorite gates, which is the area surrounding Berlin. So there, the Social Democrats or SPD party, they barely squeaked by to win with 30.9% of the vote, while the AfD, the far-right party, the neo-Nazi party, got 29.2%. So in absolute terms, it's obviously good the AfD didn't win, but Brandenburg has been a stronghold for Social Democrats for decades, like since like 1990. So a loss there would have been catastrophic and probably would have led for, you know, calls for Olaf Scholz to resign or step aside or not run again, at least. Scholz is still in some political trouble, however. He is so unpopular that local SPD members asked him not to campaign in Brandenburg. I think he lives there, too. An exit poll said that 75% of SPD voters were actually just voting against the AfD. They didn't want to see a strong far right. So listeners might be asking, why are you guys talking about local German elections so much? We don't care. The answer is, whenever there's a neo-Nazi party ascendant in Germany, we pledge to you that we're going to talk about it.
We're going to talk about it.
And there's a national election next September. So keep an eye on this one.
I think German politics is kind of the next big bellwether of where the momentum is with the far right. And clearly, there's, you know, at a minimum, this level of performance by the AfD is going to make every coalition formation difficult at the state level, at the federal level, after the next election. It bears watching. It remains concerning. As you pointed out last week, too, the AfD is not even some reconstructed far-right party. They're not even doing the kind of like Giorgia Meloni, look at us, we're more centrist now. This is not good.
Bad news. The New Yorker had a good piece last week. It was titled, "The Complicated Rise of the Right in Germany's Left Behind Places." It was very good if you want more. All right, Ben, now we're going to turn to a country where the pronunciations are going to tax me. I think listeners of this show know.
I've been most excited for this segment all day.
I think we're going to have to promise to do cuts because I just can't. We can't go this long. But I just want you all to know that I am equal opportunity when it comes to just failing to pronounce words. It can be English, it can be Spanish, it could be Sri Lankan. I'm just bad at it. So here's what you need to know. Three main contenders. Ben's looking at me like enjoying this. So there's 38 presidential candidates. They duked it out in the election over the weekend. The Marxist candidate, Anura Kumara Dissanayake, came out on top in the second round with about 56% of the vote. His next closest opponent, who is the son of the former president, actually got 44%. This is a big shakeup in Sri Lankan politics, which has been, you know, kind of run by the old guard for a lot of its history. Turnout was very high. They had 80% turnout. AKD, so we're going to call him AKD to just spare me here. Yeah. So he's represents the leftist National People's Power Coalition, of which his party, JVP, is the largest member. JVP has this kind of interesting violent history. They were involved in failed uprisings in the 70s and 80s, and he's been the leader of the party for 10 years, ran for president in 2019, but just got 3% of the vote back then. But as a lot has changed since 2019, Ben, I remember loving this story with you when in 2022 when a bunch of protesters stormed the presidential palace and they were just like swimming in the swimming pool, having a blast, doing backflips.
Yes.
That was simpler times.
Those were simpler days, simpler pronunciations.
However, it was a serious story. It was in response to a devastating economic crisis, but these guys, you know, they took it into their own hands. At the time, the president fled the country, resigned, installed somebody who was the last incumbent, and was just wildly unpopular because of a bunch of, you know, steps they had to take to deal with the IMF giving them a huge bailout.
Yeah.
Anyway, Ben, what do you think?
I think you did a great job with those names.
I know nothing about Sri Lankan politics, and I'm doing my best.
Well, look, what we know is, so first of all, you had a extended period of time that was dominated by the civil war there, right? And ultimately the crushing
the Tamil
of
the Tigers.
Tamil insurgency. And then you had this kind of autocratic turn after that, you know, the essentially an effort to kind of set up a bit of a single party state. Then you had this kind of swing to democracy. Then you had this kind of chaos. What I take away as a casual observer of Sri Lankan politics is, you know, it's interesting to see this kind of move to the populist left, right? And it actually is something healthy about that. You know, it's less about just a kind of internal dynamic and strong man politics. This is about anti-corruption, about inequality, about, you know, feeling like you've been getting screwed over by corrupt politicians and international financial institutions. And what's interesting to me about this is, if you look in the region, right, in Bangladesh, we've talked about, say, you know, similar kind of anger at political elites that were out of touch and they were not responsive and were running kind of patronage schemes. You know, there does seem to be, we've talked a lot about this kind of swing to the right, ethno-nationalist right, as a kind of defining trend of this time. You're seeing, like, you know, in different places, this kind of movement to kind of more populist anti-corruption left, which, you know, from
far
my vantage
too.
Point. Yeah.
In Germany and France.
Sometimes you can go a little far to the left, you know, but I don't know. So that to me is bears some watching, you know, just because we've seen that now in a number of places, including in South Asia, in both Bangladesh and Sri Lanka. But yeah, hope it works out for our friends over there.
That's why they pay him the big bucks, folks. That was a good analysis. All right, let's turn back to Brazil, Ben. A couple weeks ago, we talked about Twitter, now X, but I refuse to call it that, getting shut down in Brazil after Elon Musk refused to comply with a Supreme Court judge's order to shut down a bunch of accounts spreading misinformation, or in some cases, I think that this judge didn't like. The fight got messy. They dragged Elon's satellite internet company, Starlink, into the mix and were starting to penalize them. Elon made a big show of how he was fighting this and he was a free speech warrior and a hero and this and that. But in the end, he caved, as we would expect. So Twitter has now complied with Brazilian authorities by blocking the accounts that they were asked to block, paying some fines. They had to name an official representative for Twitter in Brazil. But Twitter addicts in Brazil can't get their fix quite yet. There was a court order issued Saturday that says Twitter has 5 days to provide even more legal documents to the court. But I think clearly Elon wants to get people back on there, because I think Blue Sky and Tumblr both have reported massive growth after Twitter went dark in Brazil. But Ben, like, big picture, this conversation is so annoying because obviously, like, free speech is very important. And I have a ton of respect for people that fight for it, especially in countries where there's risk to your body or legally or whatever. And there's also, I think, a pretty compelling argument that this judge in Brazil was a little out of control and just kind of like, like demanding accounts that were mean to him get blocked, even by lawmakers and things. But I just think Elon is so full of shit on this that it's hard to take it seriously, because we know in places where he has business interests, he's happy to comply with the law. He says so publicly. He did it in India. He's like, he flew to China and had a love fest with, you know, Xi Jinping.
Yeah.
He's got factories there. So the
not a lot of free speech there.
Second largest shareholder at Twitter is a Saudi prince.
I forgot that.
It's just deeply annoying.
First of all, I mean, just a side comment. What was that? Do you remember when Elon bought Twitter and all the resistance liberals started going to some new platform? It was pre-Threads. What was that called?
Blue Sky?
No, it was something else.
Spoutable?
It was just, anyway, because I was wondering if people were doing that in Brazil.
Mastodon. Is that where you did toots?
Yeah, you remember go to like a...
I didn't enjoy any of that.
Yeah, I didn't do any of that. I don't know. Side note, but it was the greatest hits of resistance Twitter, like migrating to other platforms. So I don't know if they've done that in Brazil. What I will say is this, Tommy. Like, one of the things I think we forget, because we build this picture of like all powerful tech companies, governments have more power than they think they do sometimes with these tech companies. I mean, you know, look at what's happening now. Like, the Telegram guy is sitting in fucking the Hoosegow in France, you know. Brazil just kind of squeezed Elon, and he needs that market for a bunch of things, and so he caved, right?
Like, EU passed some
laws. I think we keep learning, you know, Lina Khan has been like a real thorn in the side of tech companies since she started bringing antitrust measures here in the U.S. Like, governments have the capacity to influence the behavior of these companies, to regulate these companies, to set guardrails around these companies. I'm not saying I agree with everything the judge did, but it's a helpful reminder that this isn't some like force of nature beyond our control, which is how the tech companies are kind of presented oftentimes, particularly social media platforms. Like, there is a space for government to begin to claw back some capacity to regulate these platforms, hopefully for the public good and not just for some political interest. And I think we're seeing that correction beginning to happen.
Even the threat of regulation can get action. I mean, Instagram, I think a week ago, just took a bunch of steps to make teenagers' accounts on the platform much more private, like private by default, to make it harder to message them, to give parents more access to information about who your kids are talking to. Like, things they obviously should have done years and years ago, given the like very well-known harm that's been caused by tons of creeps basically, you know, either exploiting kids that they met on social media, like Instagram through DM, or all these like sextortion schemes that you're hearing about, where basically like gangs or criminal organizations encourage kids to send them nude photos and then like extort them with them. And it's led to like suicides and just all kinds of manners of harm. So yes, governments absolutely have more power than they at times let on. I mean, it's half our Congress who just gets bought off by these interests.
But. Well, and yeah, part of that was a bunch of state attorney generals bringing suit against Meta for this issue of teen harm on Instagram. And just one more example, like it was years ago, but Germany started really going after content moderation on Facebook. Lo and behold, it became like the place where they had like the most per capita content moderators. You know, like governments can compel action here. You know, they just have to actually act.
Yep, absolutely. A couple more quick things. So just one weird story, Ben. So listeners might remember this story from last month where there was this luxury yacht off the coast of Sicily. It sank in a freak storm. It was like the water spout, I think. Seven people died, including a British CEO named Mike Lynch. Italian prosecutors were already investigating whether criminal negligence led to the high death toll. But according to CNN, what is also complicating this investigation is suspicion that the yacht might also contain some sort of waterproof safe that includes hard drives that have on them highly sensitive data connected with Western intelligence services, including classified information, passwords, and other sensitive data. So in this past, this guy, Mike Lynch, he had a cybersecurity company, and he worked with the Brits, with U.S. intelligence and other sort of Western companies. And on top of that, apparently his business partner, this guy named Stephen Chamberlain, died the same day the boat sank after getting hit by a car a couple days earlier. I guess there's no evidence that the two events were connected, but like...
Other than every spy movie I've ever seen.
I was going to say, I've yeah. never heard a thing that's going to breed more conspiracy yeah. theories in my life than this story.
Yeah, or breed like a bunch of, you know, FX shows.
Really good limited
yeah,
series.
Yeah, really good limited series. Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, like...
That's
yeah.
the half glass full.
Yeah, no, this stage, it. You're right. It bears watching because there'd be both conspiracy theories, but also potential real world ramifications. But it does seem like a good plot for a limited series.
And then I know you really want to talk about religious tolerance in Albania.
I'm just saying we may be heading towards the world's newest state.
And smallest, right?
Yes. Albania has this proposal to create a microstate within its capital of Tirana for a Sufi Muslim sect that is focused on tolerance, all good things. I like everything I've read about this. I mean, if you're looking for potential locales, Tommy,
to move to
in the event of a Trump victory, we could be broadcasting, you know, from inside the microstate carved out of Tirana.
Now, what do you think what's the goal here? Who pitched this?
No bad ideas in a brainstorm time.
Yeah.
So this seems to be the brainchild of the Prime Minister of Albania, longtime leader of Albania, Edi Rama, who is, among other things, also like a well-known artist. You know? So he's kind of a conceptual artist, you know, so...
Like a sculptor?
Yeah, you know, various forms. I mean, I'm not saying I'm a collector.
Okay.
I'm just saying I'm familiar with his...
His oeuvre.
His oeuvre. His vibe.
Got it.
And you know, there's this history of this sect led by a guy named Baba Mundi.
Great name.
I hope I got that right. And I think, you know, the idea was that the Albanian state had kind of taken their lands over the years and worse times. Now things are good. And we also believe this microstate, kind of a mini Vatican, could be an exemplar for the brand of tolerance and, you know, religious, you know, acceptance, the message of Bobby Mundi could resonate from there.
Interesting.
You know,
well,
so, I mean, it's just, it, you know, there's stuff happening out there.
Nothing but tolerance comes out of the Vatican.
Yeah, one more country. We get one more state out there. You know,
well, listen, I'd love to go to an even smaller state. Have you been to Vatican City?
I have.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's very cool.
Did we do an Obama trip there? That might have been after.
We did an Obama trip there, and then the Obama trip was very weird.
What year was that? Do you remember?
That was 2014.
Yeah, I was gone.
And so when you wait to have the audience of the Pope, every single person in the party is assigned a gentleman, a Vatican gentleman.
I'm just going to, so many jokes that I'm not saying.
Yes. And these are people that are kind of elites in kind of Catholic Roman society. My gentleman was a lawyer. And they just stand next to you and make small talk the entire time you're waiting there. Like, that's kind of their role. They're all dressed up.
Do they have research on you? Is there like a file where they know what your interests
are? They're super chill Italian guys that you just kind of talk to. Yeah.
What are your interests?
So that was very strange, but interesting. And then I went back there, you know, when we completed the Cuban normalization.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And it's weird. Yeah, you go through these walls and suddenly you're like in a different sovereign territory.
It's cool. The funny thing about being one funny thing about being the Pope is I think everyone who visits you brings you something. And yes, there's all these hilarious videos of him just getting handed like the most priceless thing from some foreign leader person. He's like, yeah, thanks.
Yeah, yeah.
Throw in the fucking pile.
They've also been accepting gifts there for, you know, almost a couple thousand years.
Yeah, so they must have quite a storeroom.
They must, you know, the State Department has that like protocol gift storeroom. I mean, they must have a good...
I think a lot of things went missing there during the Trump era,
years,
right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like Mar-a-Lago, yeah.
$50,000 whiskey or something from Mike Pompeo.
Bunch of Saudi jewels and stuff.
Huh, funny. Last story, Ben. I regret to inform you that Chinese zoos are once again painting the animals. We've covered this in the past.
I know, it keeps coming up.
So a second zoo in China was busted for painting or dyeing dogs, D-Y-I-N-G, to look like pandas. They gave them like the cute little black eyes, the black ears, the white little midsection. If you look at the video, there's someone put it on TikTok. It's not even remotely believable, but it unraveled because there's one clip where there's this one panda with his little paws forward and he's panting like a dog. And then another cute little dog like kind of trots into the frame, wagging its fluffy little tail. And it's just so clearly not a panda. It's a chow chow that somebody just adorably painted.
I mean, first thought is like, yeah, imagine you're a kid and you're going, and you know, kids know pandas, right? They want you got to be able to see through the dog thing. And second, is it time to start questioning whether this is a, like, we all this discussion of America being in decline? I don't know, man. Over there, they're painting pandas in the zoos. Like, I don't know what's going on in China. Yeah, Xi Jinping maybe, like, this should factor into, like, the instability index in China.
Yeah.
The degree of painted pandas.
You know? Also, I did some extensive research on this, which by that, I mean, I searched once on Twitter, and I found a video of a real giant panda from this week named Ding Ding attacking this zookeeper at a different zoo and, like, going hard at this woman. She'd like fight this thing off. It's a big ass panda.
Yeah, no, these are not. I mean, we're used to seeing them all chill, like sleeping. I mean, I wouldn't want one of those things to come after me.
No.
Yeah, they'll come at you.
Not even a little bit.
Is Lizette, are you on to Stillwater yet?
What's Stillwater?
You got to watch the show. It's Apple TV Plus. It's a panda named Stillwater. Who? It's clearly like one of these shows that Apple made to like appeal to like their Chinese like audience as well, but it's this kind of, these kids live next door to this kind of wise, kind of Zen panda. And when they have problems, they go over and see the panda and he kind of tells them a story and works it out for them. And then they like do Tai Chi and drink tea and make Chinese delicacies.
That sounds great.
It's a very lovely panda.
We're still just totally in Miss Rachel. I'm hoping to get her into Bluey or even Peppa or something that's like a little more interesting for me.
When you hit the...
I love Miss Rachel, though. No offense.
Yeah, but...
I love her.
I'm just saying. Like,
Thank God for her.
It felt good at the beginning with that, you know, in kind of Sesame Street content. That's all great. The Bluey Stillwater era was a good one in my household.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I look forward to that. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, you're going to hear Ben talk with Kim Gattis about all the things happening on the ground in Lebanon, given these Israeli airstrikes into Beirut recently and the growing concern about a big-time regional war. So stick around for that.
Hi, my name is Mitch Landrieu.
My name is Erin Haynes.
My name is Jennifer Palmieri, and we're hosting a new series called Long Play. The South is the new political epicenter of the country. Democrats are way on their heels in this region, but Republicans are going through their own reckoning in the South, too.
I mean, the South has always shaped American politics. We know that.
The stakes could not be higher, but to win the South, you have to understand it.
People in the South feel really misunderstood, left behind, put down on, and they want to explain that to somebody.
We're traveling across six Southern states to explore the people, the issues, the assumptions that no longer hold, and what the rest of us are missing about a region that will shape the future of our politics and our country. From Left, Right, and Crooked Media, starting July 27th. Watch Long Play Series on YouTube at youtube.com/longplayseries or listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, my name is Mitch Landrieu.
My name is Erin Haynes.
My name is Jennifer Palmieri, and we're hosting a new series called Long Play. The South is the new political epicenter of the country. Democrats are way on their heels in this region, but Republicans are going through their own reckoning in the South, too.
I mean, the South has always shaped American politics. We know that.
The stakes could not be higher, but to win the South, you have to understand it.
People in the South feel really misunderstood, left behind, put down on, and they want to explain that to somebody.
We're traveling across six Southern states to explore the people, the issues, the assumptions that no longer hold, and what the rest of us are missing about a region that will shape the future of our politics and our country. From Left, Right, and Crooked Media, starting July 27th. Watch Long Play Series on YouTube at youtube.com/longplayseries or listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, joining me now from Beirut is Kim Gattis, a Lebanese journalist who contributes to The Atlantic and Financial Times and is also a New York Times bestselling author. Kim, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
So, I mean, just to begin, tell us a little bit about what it's like now in Beirut. What's the mood there?
Tense.
What are people doing to get ready?
In one word, it's been a rather tense week after what's been... you know, not to repeat myself, 10 months or 11 months by now since the start of the war in Gaza after the the terrifying attack that Hamas conducted on the 7th of October. On the 8th of October, Hezbollah, the Iran-backed Shia militant group in Lebanon, started launching missiles at northern Israel. And by doing that, it tied Lebanon's fate to Gaza. And it has since been demanding a ceasefire in Gaza in order to stop launching rockets at northern Israel. We've had 11 months of a war of attrition, a slow simmer between the Israelis and Hezbollah. But last week, things shifted shifted gears quite dramatically. The pager attacks were really traumatizing for the Lebanese. You didn't have to be a Hezbollah operative. You didn't have to be carrying one of these pagers to be terrorized by what happened last week, because the uncertainty of it, the sheer terror of these things, we didn't know at first what it was, exploding all over the country, in Beirut, in the southern suburbs, in the south, sirens wailing for hours, hospitals completely overwhelmed, still operating on some of these casualties, then followed by walkie-talkies exploding the next day, followed by a major strike by the Israelis in the southern suburbs of Beirut, which killed a Hezbollah commander. And since Monday, devastating air campaign by the Israelis. They say that it's targeted, but 500 people have already died. And that's a lot in one day. That's, you know, almost half of how many people died during the last war between Hezbollah and Israel in 2006. So the Lebanese are living on edge because they don't know what's next. We are in uncharted territory. They don't know what's next. And they've been watching Gaza for 11 months now, wondering whether that's their fate now.
And I mean, that makes complete sense. Are people taking precautions now in the expectation that this will continue escalating? Are there any things that can be done to kind of prepare, putting Hezbollah aside, just among the people, to prepare for what may be coming?
So some people have decided they can't take it and have left the country. Not that many, actually. Some people are coming back. I have a friend who runs a business. She has 50 employees here. Her husband and children actually live in Europe, and she commutes back and forth. And she came back because she needs to be there for her team. It's very personal. These decisions are very personal. Some people left Beirut because they're worried about a massive air campaign against Beirut, as happened in 2006 and, of course, 1982, the Israeli invasion. And people in southern Lebanon, we've had several waves of exodus from the south because the headlines are mostly about Israelis who've had to leave northern Israel, but 80,000 Lebanese have had to leave southern Lebanon over the last 11 months. And now, since Monday, thousands and thousands of them have been flooding out of the south into other parts of Lebanon, looking for safety, looking for shelter, being welcomed in schools, people's homes. How else do you prepare? I don't really know, Ben. You know, I grew up in Lebanon during the civil war. I remember a little bit the Israeli invasion of 1982. I was very, very young, but we had to leave Beirut as well. I remember hunkering in the back of my mother's car with one of my sisters, driving in the dark of night out of the city. I lived through 2006 as a reporter. I covered that war. And you try to rationalize, you stock up on a few things, water, cash, make sure your passport is handy. But you also try to carry on your normal life as much as you can until it's on your doorstep. And I was discussing that with a friend this evening. Are we in denial? Should we leave the city? Because we simply don't know what's going to happen. And by the time it's at your doorstep, it's too late. And that's how you sink into war and suddenly you can become a refugee.
Yes, well, that's quite harrowing. I mean, how are people getting information? We've seen these reports of the IDF texting people. Netanyahu's given a message to try to reach Lebanese. How is the Lebanese government communicating? And what do people make of the information that is coming their way?
So, like everybody, people are very connected here. Social media, Twitter, Instagram, very good reporters, very good media, very good newspapers. Partisan sometimes, but generally good, accurate, fast information. we don't have a president. We don't have a cabinet. We have a caretaker cabinet. They're doing the best they can, but they're also blamed for leading us into this situation. The Minister of Health has done an incredible job over the last week because their responsibility and all the hospitals, their first priority is treating the injured, and that has to remain possible for hospitals in Lebanon. When the injured come to your door and the wounded, you treat them. You don't actually ask too many questions because that's just the duty of care of a hospital. And now he's having to deal with a wave of refugee and, you know, 500 killed in one day. He's been a caretaker minister for a few years now. There's no end in sight for this political crisis. And as you mentioned, yes, there are these messages coming from Israel, automated phone calls, which freaked out a lot of people. The mother of a friend of mine received one. Another friend in his office building received one. They have nothing to do with the government. They have nothing to do with Hezbollah. It's just an office building. And they received one of those phone calls to evacuate immediately. And so they did. They left. And that is really psychological warfare. And that's why the city is very much on edge. And then you have, you know, the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, saying our war is not with you, it's with Hezbollah. I think the Lebanese are going to have a hard time believing that. Many of them oppose Hezbollah. There are a lot of opponents of Hezbollah in the political realm of life and in civilian amongst, you know, just general people. Hezbollah doesn't have a lot of political support. But the Lebanese are not going to believe the Israeli prime minister when he says we're coming after Hezbollah, not Lebanon.
Yeah. And one thing, just so our listeners understand, you know, Hezbollah has this kind of reputation, you know, in the U.S. and the West as a you know, terrorist organization opposed to Israel. But it's also deeply embedded in the Lebanese state. It's embedded in Lebanese society, Lebanese ministries. Talk a little bit about how Hezbollah fits into the complex puzzle that is Lebanon.
It's a political party with ministers in the government, with members of parliament. It's a militant group armed to the teeth, backed by Iran. And so it has now very much dual allegiance, if you will. It benefits from the system in Lebanon. It operates within that system. But I want to choose my words very carefully. It is not the system, because I know how these quotes that then get, you know, picked up by somebody somewhere and say, oh, well, you know, all of Lebanon is Hezbollah. And before we know it, you know, every hospital is Hezbollah as well. It is not ingrained, embedded in all of society. It is a strong political militant player in Lebanon, which has a support base within the Shia community. Some of it is absolute ideological willing support, and some of it, I have no doubt, is also coerced. And they're armed to the teeth. So it's also very hard to really stand up to them. And people have, and they got shot, and they got killed, and they got blown up. You know, the Lebanese Prime Minister, Rafiq Hariri, 2005, Hezbollah stands accused of killing him. And there's a litany of names as well. And also, Hezbollah is a regional paramilitary player. They were deeply involved on the side of Bashar al-Assad in Syria, supporting his regime, making it possible for him to survive. And that means that they also have a lot of Syrian blood on their hands, something that, you know, most people in the West don't quite realize. But, you know, they were essential. And so they are an element of the, you know, microcosm of Lebanese society, but they certainly don't represent all of it. If you know, you know, I would say, you know, I'm not going to get into percentages, but you know, I would say a minority.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Well, with respect to Hezbollah, is there any sense of how much the Pedro attacks and the various strikes have thrown them off balance, degraded their leadership, and how do you balance, you know, their kind of imperative to respond to what Israel's doing versus whatever losses they may need to process here?
So I would say that these are some of the heaviest, most dramatic losses that have been inflicted on Hezbollah in a very long time, if ever, since their creation in the 80s. it looks to me like the whole top tier and second tier of leadership has been decapitated, save a few. The pager attacks, and that has been done over the last 10 months, you know, this sort of constant assassinations by Israel of these commanders in the field, and now more high-ranking assassinations with these more recent strikes. And then the pager attacks, you know, I can imagine that any organization that suddenly loses its means to communicate, even temporarily, will face some chaos and some difficulty regrouping. So I think there's no doubt that they're on the back foot, that their strategy isn't working. Their strategy lies in tatters. They thought that they could just, you know, maintain this war of attrition and uphold the flag of Palestine without endangering Lebanon, because they actually don't want an all-out war with Israel. Neither does their patron, Iran. But I think they're finding out that their strategy, that they miscalculated, that they misread Israel, that Israel was actually willing to escalate, to try to take them out at whatever cost. And we'll see what cost that will be for the Lebanese. I would say that they're currently in chaos, that they have been decapitated at the leadership level, that that can be dangerous because you decapitate the leadership and then the man at the top, Hassan Nasrallah, might have some trouble organizing the younger level, more inexperienced guys who might not follow orders, want revenge for the losses that they've sustained, their colleagues, etc. We have to remember they are, to some extent, whether we like them or not, rational actors. So you have to understand their analysis. They're going to want revenge as well. How exactly they do it and whether they still have the capacity today or whether they need to regroup, I do think that they will try to still strike some, you know, destructive blows on Israel.
And I mean, looking at Israel, I mean, you've obviously been an analyst of this for many years. Part of what is so worrying to me is that even if Hezbollah's on the back foot, they're not going to be eliminated. And so Israel appears to be escalating and achieving a bunch of tactical goals, but to what end? You know, I mean, it's not unlike Gaza in a way, in the sense that it's hard to see what the end game is. I mean, what do you make of Israel's intentions here in taking these steps now? And where do you think they might be going?
Very hard to say. Very hard to say, Ben, because they are saying that they want to escalate so that they can de-escalate. They want to escalate so that Hezbollah raises the white flag. Hezbollah is not going to admit defeat. I mean, Hamas hasn't admitted defeat 11 months into this war, right? And so again, we have to understand the rationale of these actors. Hezbollah has lost a lot of its aura of invincibility. Its base is afraid. I mean, Hezbollah can't protect them. They're refugees now. They're being blown up. Their pagers exploding everywhere. And it looks like there isn't much help coming. It doesn't sound to me at the moment like the cavalry is coming, because today in New York, the Iranian president and foreign minister indicated that they were ready to negotiate with the United States about the nuclear file. So that's the context in which Hezbollah operates. And in addition, we heard the Iranian president say that Hezbollah cannot take on Israel on its own. But he didn't say, we're coming to its rescue. Iran wants to preserve its regime at all costs. And so I think Hezbollah is finding itself a little bit isolated. Now, I've learned one thing, which is never to write about the demise of Hezbollah or Iran until, you know, it can be verified. So we'll have to see, you know, how that evolves. But when it comes to Israel, you know, we've been waking up in Beirut for 11 months now with one minister or another, one settler leader or another, calling for the annihilation of Beirut, of Lebanon, calling us all Hezbollah, you know, talking about annexation of southern Lebanon. Just now, you know, random people, but that add to the echo chamber tweeting about, you know, once we, you know, expel all the Shias from southern Lebanon, the Christians can decide whether they want to be part of Israel or not, and otherwise they can leave too. You know, that kind of language, it's an understatement, what I'm going to say, is not conducive to long-term peace in this region. So to wake up every day with people calling for your annihilation, which the Israelis themselves complain about, right? I mean, they complain that they get to hear that Iran wants to erase Israel, but they say the same. And so what exactly are Israel's intention? If they think that they can escalate to de-escalate, I can tell you now that that's not going to work. I've written a piece in the Financial Times, which will be out today in the paper, or tomorrow rather, saying that on Thursday, saying that we have a short window of opportunity for diplomacy to achieve quick results and try to contain this very quickly while everybody's in New York. And that is to offer a face-saving way out for Hezbollah, because Israel may want to humiliate Hezbollah. Even America would like to humiliate Hezbollah for the Marines bombing attack in the 80s. You know, Hezbollah is not on everybody's, on many people's, you know, favorite list. So you may want to humiliate them, but you need to give them an off ramp. I don't know that they'll take it. And so you need to give them an off ramp whereby they can say, yes, we have supported Palestine for Gaza for 11 months. But we understand that now Lebanon is at stake, and for the sake of Lebanon, we're going to stand down. What that requires then, Ben, is America getting ironclad guarantees from the Israelis that they will also stand down. And the Biden administration does not have a great track record over the last 11 months getting Israel to do what it's being asked by the Biden administration.
Yeah, or being able to guarantee that it can deliver Israel and that kind of negotiation. Well, one last question. I mean, you mentioned the civil war. You mentioned the 2006 war. You've had the collapsed economy there. You've had, you know, government dysfunction. You had the explosion in Beirut and the port a few years ago. How does this moment fit into that context? I mean, is this just a resilient people that are dealing with yet another crisis, or does this feel somehow different?
Can I swear on the podcast?
Yes, we swear all the time.
Okay. So I just thought I'd check. So we're not very fond of the word resilience in this country anymore because people are exhausted. Mm-hmm. Without revealing my age, it has, you know, war and conflict have dominated my whole life. I still cry when I watch some of the coverage of the 2006 war when I was with the BBC. But there is something about this country. It really should be in utter chaos and complete sort of, you know, disarray, with gangs roaming the streets and people locked up at night behind, you know, metal bars for fear of, you know, robberies, etc. But civil order has somehow remained a constant in this country. I feel safer walking on the streets of Beirut, except for Israeli shelling now, but safer walking on the streets of Beirut than I would on the streets of New York at night. The sense of community remains strong despite everything, and that's how this country somehow continues to function. And I have a friend who has covered, as a journalist, all sorts of war-torn countries, you know, Somalia, Bosnia, Sarajevo, you name it, she's covered it. And she came to Lebanon for the first time in 2015 after a wave of bomb attacks and assassinations. And she was just surprised. She said, wow, this is the most normal, fucked up country I've ever been to. And I think that really sums it up. We're always looking for the next solution, the next way to adapt. And as I said at the beginning of our conversation, you know, we keep things going for as long as we can. The downside of that, I have found, is that we don't necessarily fix things. We paper over, we put band-aids. And as long as we can still be with our family, be with our friends, go to Sunday lunch, go to the mountains at the weekend, enjoy the sunshine, we're willing to, you know, let go of all the things that aren't working. But people are also exhausted. You know, the port explosion was incredibly traumatic. It's imprinted in all our DNA. And now we're going through war again. And of course, you know, we went through COVID. But I always say Lebanon is always a playground, never a player. And so a lot of regional conflicts are settled here. A lot of what is wrong in the region explodes here. And a lot of what gets resolved first gets resolved here. I often quote Amos Oz, an Israeli journalist and author and peace activist, who was very much opposed to Israel's invasion of Lebanon in 1982. And he said at the time, you know, we can never atone for what we did in Beirut. And I think that we're still living with the consequences of what was unleashed in 1982 and how that changed Lebanon, Israel, Iran, and the U.S.
Yeah. No, well, it's a good reminder that these decisions, they have generational implications. So let's hope for the sake of the people of Lebanon that things don't get any worse, but really do appreciate you coming on to share the perspective, and everybody should check out your article in the Financial Times and continue to follow your work. So thanks so much, Kim.
Thanks so much, Ben. Thank you.
Thanks again to Kim Gattis for joining the show. And that's it for us this week.
That's it.
Have fun at UNGA, Ben.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. I love being around there. I don't love the traffic. But it'll be fun.
You're gonna. Have a
good time. I'll come back with some gossip.
Yeah, you could get multilateral for us.
I'll get multilateral.
All right,
see you soon. Sustainable development goals.
If you want to get ad-free episodes, exclusive content, and more, consider joining our Friends of the Pod subscription community at crooked.com/friends. Don't forget to follow us at Crooked Media on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter for more original content, host takeovers, and other community events. Plus, find Pod Save the World on YouTube for access to full episodes, bonus content, and more. If you're as opinionated as we are, consider dropping a review. Pod Save the World is a Crooked Media production. Our producer is Alona Minkowski. Our associate producer is Michael Goldsmith. Our executive producers are me, Tommy Vitor, and Ben Rhodes. The show is mixed and edited by Andrew Chadwick and engineered by Vasilis Fotopoulos. Audio support by Kyle Seglin and Charlotte Landis. Madeline Herringer is our head of news and programming. Matt DeGroat is our head of production. Andy Taft is our executive assistant. Thanks to our digital team, Phoebe Bradford, William Jones, Kirill Palaviv, and Molly Lobel, who upload our episodes and videos to youtube.com/podsavetheworld.
Hi, my name is Mitch Landrieu.
My name is Erin Haynes.
My name is Jennifer Palmieri, and we're hosting a new series called Long Play. The South is the new political epicenter of the country. Democrats are way on their heels in this region, but Republicans are going through their own reckoning in the South, too.
I mean, the South has always shaped American politics. We know that.
The stakes could not be higher, but to win the South, you have to understand it.
People in the South feel really misunderstood, left behind, put down on, and they want to explain that to somebody.
We're traveling across 6 Southern states to explore the people, the issues, the assumptions that no longer hold, and what the rest of us are missing about a region that will shape the future of our politics and our country. From Left, Right, and Crooked Media, starting July 27th, watch Long Play series on YouTube at youtube.com/longplayseries or listen wherever you get your podcasts.